Diversification Portfolio Committee. Chairperson, can I please hand over to you now?
Thank you very much. Good morning to everybody. I'm acknowledging the chairs that are here. There is a chair from the Select Committee, from the NCOP, and Honorable Chairperson Mapulani from Higher Education, Science and Technology. I'm not sure if basic education is led by the minister or DM, but the deputy minister and Minister Nzimande from Higher Education and Science and Technology, you are all welcome. The officials that are here from both the departments and parliament. We are meeting just after the release of matric results yesterday, which we are all excited about the outcome, and congratulations to Team Basic Education. I think against all odds, you have tried and you have delivered. So as a nation, really, we cannot blame you for the drop, but I think we need to appreciate the fact that you have delivered 76.2%. Members, you know in our agenda we are having a briefing from both the department, basic education, and we will have the department of higher education that will be briefing us on the admissions and NSFAS funding. And then after that, we will have the impact on SONA 2021 from DBE. So without really wasting time, any apologies, Llewellyn?
Thank you, Chairperson. I have received apologies from members, Honorable Dr. Tembe Kwayo, as well as Honorable Yabo, who contributed us this morning. I've also received from the department an apology for the Minister for Basic Education, as well as the Deputy Minister for Higher Education, and also just to indicate that Dr. Nzimande has requested that he be released at around 10:30. He also has to attend an NCCC meeting later this morning. Chairperson, those are the apologies from my side. I'm not sure from the others. Thank you. Sorry, Chairperson, one other thing. I do know that the Portfolio Committee on Higher Education has another meeting this morning, but I've been told that the Chairperson will join us this morning at least for some time. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, that's fine. Any apologies from the Select Committee?
Good morning, Honorable Members, DM, Honorable Minister Zimande, and everyone present in the meeting. Chair, I don't have an apology on the Select Committee side. It's just that the Chairperson is still trying to join the meeting. He's struggling with the network. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Department of Higher Education, the Portfolio Committee, Honorable Mapulani.
Good morning, Chair, and good morning, members, morning, Minister, and DF. The Portfolio Committee on Higher Education, Science and Technology is having a briefing this morning. It's receiving a briefing from HSR and DSI. So a number of members will be attending that meeting. I'm here representing the committee. And I think another member might be joining me. It has not yet been confirmed, but I'm here. I'll be here for the rest of the meeting.
Okay, Siyabonga, Honorable Mapulani. Members, those are the apologies. Any apologies from Department of Higher Education? Sirai, welcome to Monday.
We are okay, other than the apology from the Deputy Minister. I'm also joined by my special advisor, the three of them, Honorable Chair, my Chief of Staff, and Ms. Tandi Lewin, who is going to be making the presentation, who is the Acting Deputy Director General for University Education. And also, I think, yes, Ms. Aruna Singh is joining us, who is also Acting DDG for TVET Colleges. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Dear Bonga. That is Monday. DM? Basic Education?
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, members. Good morning, Minister and Zimande. Chairperson, from our side, the only apology we have is from the Minister, which has just been alluded to. So the entire team is here led by the DG. But what I would love to say is that the DG's connectivity might be on and off, but we do have DDGs in this meeting who will take the presentations, but they are all led by the DGs. There's no apology from the side of the support from the senior officials of the department, and all our regular attendees are in the meeting. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, DM. Members, as I have alluded to the agenda of today, can we adopt and move for a can we move and adopt for the agenda?
Chairperson, I move for the adoption of the agenda.
Thank you, Honorable Advance. And Seconda?
Chairperson, I second.
Thank, is that Honorable Malas? Thank you very much. We are not going to waste time because the Minister for Higher Education will have to leave us at some point. So I will hand over to you, Honorable Minister, to lead the briefing. And then, of course, you will leave everything then to your officials. So when the time has arrived for you to leave and you would have been done with the presentation, you can just excuse yourself. You can continue, Minister.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. I'm keeping my video closed because I'm having a problem with my network. It's not as strong, so it's not because of. Anyway, I've got my mask, and I'm hidden in any case, so it doesn't make much difference. Chair, as I said, I'm going to be asking Ms. Tandi Lewin to make the presentation. I may, at the end of her presentation, make one or two additional points, if necessary. It's not going to be, and that also is not going to take a long time. So if you, our focus really is on the situation with the universities now, the end of the 2020 academic year and the beginning of the 2021 academic year. As you know, some universities have not finished. And then the situation with TVET colleges. And then we're going to talk about, of course, obviously, enrollment issues, including highlighting the UNISA matter, which is an issue that is in the limelight at the moment, as well as also maybe highlighting a bit, Tandi, when you present the matter relating to the NSFAS communique that was released on the 12th of February, which we are going to indicate that there are some corrections that are going to be made to that. Because the manner in which it was communicating it communicated it might be misleading, but we are sorting that out. And then on NSFAS, unfortunately, we won't be able to talk much about the budget, Chair. We're going to talk a bit more about the number of applications and the situation and what is happening now with regards to processing. of NSFAS applications because we are in that phase now. But on the budget of NSFAS, we are not able to say much until the main budget is presented by the Minister of Finance tomorrow. So that's just a summary of the issues, but Thandi is going to take us through the presentations. Thank you very much. Over to Thandi, with your permission, Chairperson. Thank you.
You can proceed. Good morning, Chairperson. Good morning, Honourable Members, Minister, and colleagues. I believe that I should share the presentation. I'm just going to see if that is possible. And then I will ask my colleague, Ms. Singh, to come in when necessary on the TV issues. So let me just put this onto screen to slideshow and go there. Chairperson, is it clear on the screen?
Yes, it is, ma'am.
Thank you very much. So thank you very much for inviting us, and hope that we can give you a presentation that meets expectations. As the Minister has said, I will try and focus on some of the issues that have been coming up in the public domain recently. Just an overview of the presentation, we wanted to talk about the university preparation for the 2021 academic year, which is due to start in the next couple of months, over the next couple of months, to talk about the plans for the year, also a little bit of reflection on the 2020 academic year. We're also going to talk, as the Minister has indicated, on the university enrollment planning process and what that means for the system, to provide some information on the Central Applications Clearinghouse, or CACH, which is the system that we have launched yesterday. Also, just to align with the discussions that will be presented in the DBE presentation, to talk a little bit about some of the initiatives that are there in the Department to support quality teacher education and the work that the Department does in collaboration with the Department of Basic Education. And then we will also talk to the TVET enrollment figures, and then a very short slide, a few slides on NSFAS applications and funding decisions. So just in terms of the 2020 academic year, I think it goes without saying that it was an extremely challenging year for the university system. And this was due to the fact that we had to make emergency changes to the teaching and learning program in all universities in response to the pandemic. Most universities implemented shutdowns from March, and over a period of time began emergency remote teaching and learning programs. The plans of universities took very different forms. They needed to take into account the different conditions and the circumstances of institutions, as well as within institutions, the different kinds of programs, the requirement for students to be at times present on campus, the different needs for and opportunities for remote learning. Also, a great deal of work put into supporting academic staff to transition to various forms of online and distance and remote learning. All institutions established the COVID-19 task teams. These are in all institutions still in place. Those task teams combine representation from university management, from the unions that represented on campus, and student representation as well. And those task teams have been extremely active over the past year in responding to the various health and safety needs of the university, but also monitoring the teaching and learning programs and the many changes that have had to take place over time. The department provided quite intensive support to institutions, including on matters of teaching and learning. You know, institutions had to produce teaching and learning plans, extensive work on health and safety, and maybe just to acknowledge here also the support of our sector organization called Higher Health, which has done incredible work to support support the department and the institutions and the PSET sector as a whole to be able to respond effectively to the pandemic, both through training and all kinds of support programs, including mental health support, which was expanded during the pandemic. In terms of campus returning plans, there's been quite a lot of engagement and other areas of support. The department had to release a number of sets of directions to support the system during the various levels of lockdown and the different layers of complexity at the different points in the lockdown period. The department also regularly monitors universities on the basis of indicators that have been agreed with the system. Those monitoring reports have continued. We are likely to make changes to them for the next academic year, but we are finalizing currently another monitoring report which reflects on the February period. The minister also approved what we call the COVID responsiveness grant to assist universities with the costs that were incurred and the resources that were required to support the move to emergency teaching and learning. To give you an example, many of the universities had to make emergency changes to their learning support systems, their learning management systems, to enable much stronger support online and to enable assessment, etc., etc. That a lot of that work, there was also work that was supporting data provision for students and staff, and in some institutions also the provision of devices. So much of the, and of course also once universities returned and staff and students began to return over a staggered period of time, also the need to support all the health and safety protocols that are required to make sure that students and staff remain safe on campus. So that COVID responsiveness grant was actually created from reprioritized funds that were actually held at institutions from various of the earmarked grants that the department provided. Also well known is that NISFA students continue to receive their allowances for the academic year. This was critical for students that while they may have been studying at home and sometimes in quite difficult conditions, they weren't all able to return to campus, some until quite late in the calendar year, and living allowances were continued for students who were NISFA recipients for the and indeed also for the extended academic year. The minister announced that for those students that would need to continue for the extended academic year, that allowances would be paid for those students. Most of the institutions have either completed or are in the process of completing their academic programs at the moment, but I'll talk more about that when I talk about the 2021. Also important to note that we negotiated a framework for the tuition and accommodation fees for the year, which was implemented across the system quite successfully, really to try and mitigate against the additional costs that would be incurred for tuition and accommodation given the extension of the academic year, but also to support our institutions to engage with private accommodation providers for the extended academic year period. That's been a really important initiative to try and keep the costs at affordable levels, both for individuals, for fee-paying students, for NISFA students, and for the institutions, as well as for accommodation providers who may have lost some income during the period of the lockdown. Students returned to campuses at different times, and this was according to guidance that was provided in directions in a government gazette issued on the 8th of June. Universities provided various different forms of support to students, and I've mentioned some of this already, including access to devices. In all institutions, students were given access to data, which was also supported through negotiations that the department led with the major network operators in all its institutions to try and support teaching and learning. But also to indicate that in many institutions, the decision was taken to also supply hard copy materials to students during the lockdown so that they could continue studying. And some really quite big logistical processes to try and get materials to students in some of the institutions. And in other institutions, there was a combination of both, depending on the situation of students. So just to make that point, because we're not just talking about online forms of learning here, we're talking about remote emergency forms of learning that included the use of hard copy materials, the use of all kinds of social media and engagement with students through cell phone technology, as well as a growth in online support, but essentially for forms of blended learning. And in addition, in line with the commitment to ensure that every student was given an opportunity to complete the academic year, once students were able to return to campuses, there were further teaching and learning programs in many institutions. Those are some of the things that are completing now: adjusted timetables, catch-up programs, and additional support. And maybe to indicate also that the minister had a COVID-19 task team that was chaired by the deputy minister, and that involved all the stakeholders in the post-school system, which also provided significant support and guidance on the various changes that happened during the year. And our hashtag really was to try and save lives and save the academic year. So relatively successfully, most institutions have completed the academic year and have provided catch-up programs, have provided opportunities for students to do supplementary and repeat examinations. These are the detailed plans for the 2021 academic year. And maybe not to just go through every one, but just to give you a sense of what is happening across the system and a general and an overview of that. So a number of most institutions closed their applications in 2020. And of course, most institutions, as you know, nowadays are using mostly the online mode for applications. And this is, you know, this is a trend that's been happening in the system for some time, and it works quite well. It also avoids the challenges of walk-ins happening at the beginning of the year. So registrations have been staggered. There are some courses where the 2021 academic year started. In particular, you'll know that medical students tend to start earlier in the year. So many of the 2021 medical students have started already. But on the whole, most institutions are starting the academic year from March. You will see that institutions have also been staggering admissions and registration process. So the registrations are taking place over time, slightly earlier for the returning students, and then later, obviously, for the first years, given that it was necessary to wait for the release of the matric results before institutions can finalize their admissions decisions for first-time entering students. So you'll see, at most institutions, you will see the academic year commencing between the 1st of March, mostly starting around the middle of March, and continuing until the middle of April. Just to say that there are a minority of institutions that are still also staggering the completion of various 2020 academic activities, whether it's examinations or supplementary examinations. In some cases, work, integrated learning, etc. But for most of the time, you'll see the institutions are about to start this period is about to start the academic year. We have detail on all the institutions in case that information is of interest and of use to people. Just to say also that most institutions are doing online registrations. There are very few institutions that would take what are known as walk-in applications, partly because most of the places would be filled through the admissions and registration process that follows now, but also because of the difficulties and particularly now with the pandemic of the possibilities of walk-ins, but also to say that we do have the catch process, which I will talk a little bit about now, which assists institutions in filling spaces where there haven't been spaces filled. So you will see there the majority of institutions are doing admissions decisions now, and then they are admitting students from the 15th of March, and some even earlier than that. This is just an overview of all the institutions, just so you can get a sense of the trends. But I won't go and read all of that because it's quite a lot of detail. Just going through all of these here. So we are about to hit the registration period. As I've said, individual universities make their admissions decisions. This is well known. And as you can see, we've got quite a complex situation this year with staggered registrations. And of course, a delayed start to the academic year, but of course most institutions will be trying to complete the 2021 academic year by the end of the calendar year, and we do believe that in most institutions this will be possible. Of course, we can't be sure on the trajectory of the pandemic and how that might affect academic activities. But just to say that the department will be closely monitoring institutions, particularly the teaching and learning plans, and also on safety matters. But it is likely that we should have a smoother academic year, and that what we are trying to do is also to hopefully later this week issue adjusted directions to the institutions, which can provide generalized guidance to institutions on the effective management of the academic year, but in line with national regulations. And we would like to try and do that so that it holds for the academic year. What we are hoping is that we don't face a situation where we have to send students and staff back home on a mass basis, but of course that really does depend on the pandemic. Ideally, what we would want to do is to be able to get through the academic year, and maybe also to say that institutions are, of course, utilizing a lot more blended methodologies for teaching and learning, where they will obviously have to restrict the numbers of students and staff on campus in class, given the safety, the need to make sure that people are safe, and the physical distancing requirements. But so there is a lot more utilization of online methods. But for many students, the necessity to be living on or near campus so that they can access university Wi-Fi and residence Wi-Fi is very important. So even if they're not able to be on campus in class on a daily basis, that they are able to continue working on their academic program. So that's just the situation for the current academic year. Now, in terms of the enrollment planning process, I think also members will know this, that the department negotiates enrollment targets with universities in cycles. And at the moment, we are in the cycle of 2020 to 25. This ministerial statement on student enrollment planning is in place at the moment. And this is a six-year enrollment planning process. So we completed that in 2019. And it has been in place since last year. This is a very detailed process that works with institutions to identify the numbers of enrollments that institutions are able to take in particular areas. It talks to the spread of courses in institutions. It is informed by infrastructure demands at institutions and availability. It's also informed by institutional areas of specialization and where new areas of growth are proposed. That is also dealt with through the enrollment planning process. It also deals with, looks at the staffing capacity of institutions as well. So, but what happens is there's a mid-year review, which will take place from March to May 2022. What that allows us to do is to look at the financial situation, to reevaluate where there may be changes needed, and in particular to look at field priorities and where there might need to be shifts at the system level to try and deal with urgent and priority skills. The following slide actually shows the enrollment figures for the number of first-time entering students and the spaces, which is what we normally present to the portfolio committee at the end of the year. Just to say also that enrollment planning on the one hand is about taking account of the resources and the staffing capacity in the system, as well as the fiscal the pocket of funding that is available to the system to support enrollment in the universities. The main component of the university block grant is based on teaching input units, and therefore based on and linked to the enrollment plan. And so it's critical on the finance side, but and therefore to the sustainability of the system. But it's also critical on the quality teaching and learning side, because what we are really trying to do is not to create a revolving door syndrome where we have young people coming into the system and not being able to complete and succeed at their studies. And so it's really important that we are able to support quality teaching and learning, and that we balance the enrollments that we take into the university system with the ability to support students to succeed. This slide gives you a sense of the enrollment basis for first-time entering students in public universities in 2021. And just to maybe point out here the issue that the minister raised at the beginning, that the numbers for all unfunded undergraduate programs in the system is 184,315. That's according to the enrollment plans of institutions. But that does include the UNISA reduction in terms of 20,000, which has been discussed with UNISA and agreed by UNISA. And maybe just to explain that a little bit, UNISA, as you know, is a very big institution, and it has enrollment planned like all other universities. However, over the past few years, in particular in 2018 and 2020, UNISA had over-enrolled significantly on their first-time entering students. And just to say, this has a massive effect on the system, because the teaching input units in the system that form up the block grant are spread across the system based on enrollments. When an institution over-enrolls significantly, it has an effect on the funding of other institutions, as it reduces the amount of funding that's available to those institutions. And so that's why the enrollment planning process is so important, because it is about maintaining a delicate balance of sustainability to all the institutions. And again, I've raised the quality issues as well, and the importance of ensuring that the students that we can bring into the system, we can support. So both for financial and other reasons, and the other issues, of course, that once the students are admitted into the system, and if they are over enrollment, that has a knock-on effect on subsequent academic years. It also has a significant effect on the NSFAS budget, given that larger numbers of students, growing numbers of students, are qualifying for NSFAS funding, and those students need to be funded through NSFAS and throughout their studies. So that is the reason for the reduction. Essentially, the minister has a responsibility to ensure that the system is adequately funded, that the system is sustainable, and that the system is producing quality and supporting students adequately to succeed, and hence the engagement with UNISA. Just in terms of the scarce skills program, you'll see that there's places of 67,863, and these are the programs that we specifically track according to priority skills needs that have been identified in the system. You will see in engineering, life and physical sciences, human health, animal sciences, and veterinary sciences that there's been a specific emphasis on those programs and on ensuring that those programs are adequately filled so we can create skills in those areas. And the teacher education, also critically important, an area that I think the DBE presentation will talk to a little more. Just a quick overview of the Central Applications Clearinghouse, which has been in operation for some years now. Hopefully in the long term we will have a Central Applications Office that will be able to offer students a centralized place for applying for post-school education and training and funding. That is still in progress, but given the high competition for spaces, particularly in universities, what we find is that even if students do meet the minimum requirements, that there are often not enough spaces in the system for everyone that applies. So the catch is the system for those who have applied for a space but have not been able to obtain a space. And it's a referral system essentially. Students sign up for catch, they send an SMS with an ID number to that number there, 31629. They can register or sign up online if they're able to do that at catch.dhed.gov.za, or they can send an email to catch@dhed.gov.za. This process has opened from yesterday, given that the NSC results were released from yesterday, and it will be open until May this year. What it does is it assists students to find suitable places in other universities, but also in TVET colleges and other parts of the system where there may be spaces available. And it also provides advice by referring students to the Career Development Services line, which I will provide the information on just now. CATS doesn't guarantee any applicant a place to study, and it doesn't also take over the admissions processes that institutions themselves run, and so it doesn't handle the admissions. The Career Development Services, I think this is fairly well known and fairly well marketed, but a really important service provided to young people, particularly those who may be struggling to access their first choice. And you can call, you can get a please call me, call back, and you can also check through email and through the website to get career advice. And then what happens with the CATS process is when they receive an SMS from the student, an agent actually calls an applicant back, and then they register all the requested details. All those details are captured on the system, and then they are confirmed on the system, and then students will receive information when it becomes available. And institutions also use the system to retrieve the list of students who meet their criteria, where, for example, they have programs that they haven't been able to fill spaces in, and then they contact students. So it's both a referral service for institutions as well as for students. And then, as I've indicated, it will operate from the 22nd of February, that's yesterday, until the 30th of April, and the operation times are Mondays to Friday between 8 and 6 p.m. and on Saturday from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. And hopefully you will be seeing quite a lot of public communications on the CATS service so that people know how to register and how to access the service. Just a last slide from me, I think, just to talk a little bit about the initiatives of the department to support quality teacher education, and just to also complement the DBE presentations on this issue. And to note that the Department of Higher Education and the DBE work very, very closely on issues around particularly initial teacher education, and that we are doing quite a lot of work to support universities, all the way from preschooling, all the way to post-schooling sectors, including support for early childhood development and lecturers also for TVET and CET colleges. There are 24 public universities that provide initial and continuing education in the country. This is 24 out of 26 public universities. So teacher education is a really important part of our higher education system. And as the Department of Basic Education will probably talk more about this, the shift has been towards focusing on the supply of teachers in specialization areas required, and the responsiveness to new requirements in the basic education system, rather than just paying attention to the numbers, given that we are now producing adequate numbers of graduates in teacher education after the initiatives of the last many years, but now paying more attention to supply and demand in specific areas, in subject areas in particular. The department also has done substantive work in engaging with the institutions and the system on the focus on quality teacher education program, and also the professionalization of teachers and lecturers in teacher education. Maybe not to give a long list of projects, but perhaps if there are questions on those, I can do. There's a huge range of programs that have been initiated in the department, some with EU sector support, a number of strategic interventions, both at the policy level, so a number of policies that talk to the offering of professional education, so policies around the professionalization of ECD education, also Mr. Tech, which is the minimum requirements for teacher education qualifications, and then more recently work particularly around the policies around professional education for TVET and CET lecturers, and a growing number of institutions offering programs in those areas. And then, as I've indicated, a number of strategic interventions across primary teacher education, the teaching of African languages, special needs education, and many other areas, and a huge amount of work going on with institutions, both on the research side and on the practice side, working with DBE as well. And then all of the products or the research results and the materials that are developed as part of these initiatives are uploaded onto the National Open Learning System, which is managed by the Department of Higher Education and Training. And then I'm going to hand over to my colleague Aruna Singh, who's going to talk a little bit about the TVET enrollment for 2021. Thanks, Jefferson.
Thank you, Tandy. Tandy, can you assist with the lessons on for the TVET presentation? Thank you very much. Good morning. Good morning. Thanks, Andy. Good morning to the honorable person and the minister and new officials of the different departments, and the honourable members, of course. I have about 10 slides, and I will go through them as quickly as I can. Honourable members, this presentation provides a good bit of data on the current enrolments. We will start off with the completion of the 2020 academic year, but moving to the 2021 academic year. But I want to emphasize right from the outset that the data is very fluid at the moment, with colleges having opened in late January and results having been released just 2 weeks ago. The enrollment process is just about tailing off in the colleges. So I would like the figures that we present here to be taken in that context. So if we look at this slide here, what it says is that there is actually no carryover from the 2020 academic year into 2021 for the TVET colleges. When with the pandemic, you know, having taken its toll last year, pretty much around the middle of the year, the academic calendar for 2020 was amended. And what we had done last year was changed the approved calendar from three trimesters to two trimesters and one semester. And of course, the year program remained the same. So by the end of the year, we found that all enrolled and qualifying students had written their national exams across all the examinations that the students had been enrolled in. And those were concluded in December, the last batch, and we found that the results were successfully released on the 5th of February this year, which is just 2 weeks ago. What we also had was online applications for TVET colleges for the 2021 year. That would be for first-time enrollment. That opened in October of 2020, and over 300,000 applications were received last year. But you will see in the slide that will be presented after this and in the table that the translation from the online applications into actual registrations within a short space of time is not really realized, and we'll cover that in the challenges. So just to indicate also that when the enrollment process opens in TVET colleges and to the time that the actual enrollments are finalized, all of this is done against an approved enrollment plan. All 50 colleges develop enrollment plans, and that happens in the previous year. For 2021, it would have happened in the 2020 academic year. And this is based, of course, on the subsidies that is provided that are provided by the fiscus to cover enrollment. And the fiscus essentially covers the enrollment in the National Certificate of Vocational and the Report 191 program. So the planning is largely around those two offerings, and they have to do with the spaces that are available and the facilities and a host of issues related to provision. But in the slides that you will see that will follow shortly, we speak of the total planned targets in each college. Now, the total planned targets include all the enrollments that the college will target for the 2021 academic year. And that would include other programs, which we commonly call occupational programs, such as those offered in our centers of specialization, those that are funded by CETAs, what we call the occupational programs that are registered with the QCTO and are also funded from alternate sources of funding. So all of that comes into the planning process in each of the colleges, and that is what they provide to us as their planned, total planned targets. Needless to say that those figures are usually finalized in the course of the year. So as the year unfolds and many of these programs are of shorter duration, so the enrollments happen in the course of the year and those figures come through. So enrollments in TVET colleges are pretty much a rolling target. Even though the planning is fixed and is done ahead of time, but they begin to do these enrollments against those planned targets. In relation to the results that have just been released for the 2020 grade 12 learners and those who wish to enroll in TVET colleges, the provision is that these students will apply if they enroll, if they wish to enroll for the trimester program, which are the engineering programs. We will not enroll them in the current trimester, which already started, and it is a very short period of learning. It is literally about 3 months before they go into their national exam. So these students will be considered for trimester two, which is in April. Their enrollments will be finalized in April. With regard to the semester students, which are the business studies and the services related programs, those students may be considered for semester one or semester two, depending, of course, on the nature or the type of the program they want to enroll in. And these are the kind of decisions that the colleges will take on an individual basis, and they will communicate that accordingly to the students who would have applied to them. So that is pretty much, you know, the broad picture on how the enrollments for the 2021 academic year is being managed across the system. In the next slide, just a little bit of explanation on how we are dealing with the data. The data is provided in six regions in the TVET college system. We do not speak of nine provinces, instead we speak of six regions. And for the honorable members of the select committee, just to highlight that Gauteng and Free State are combined, they form one region, and so is the Western and Northern Cape, another region, and Northwestern and Mpumalanga again form one combined region. The remaining regions are just for Freestanding, KZN, and Eastern Cape that are not combined. And as I said, you know, as much as we are providing the data at this stage, this data is subject to very extensive verification and finalization. And we have accepted them at this stage just for the support, and they have come directly from colleges. But what it does do is it provides a snapshot of the enrollments nationally. And the processes still need to be undertaken to deal with the very high volume of walk-ins that we have in the TVET system. Earlier on, I mentioned online applications. This we started about 2 years ago, but it is by no means a mature system in the TVET colleges. It is where we want to go. It's a good start. Over 300 online enrollments is a huge increase from the previous years. But we do need to refine the systems a great deal and to make sure that it works, well, almost as good we'd like to have it as a university system. What we, the figures that we provide effectively reflect the headcount enrollments, the figures that we will see in the tables. And just to clarify that the enrollments that are reflected as total enrollments cover headcount enrollments also for the subsequent periods of study, such as the subsequent semester and the subsequent trimesters. So the enrollment figures will only become available at appropriate times when enrollment takes place, but of course they will be guided by the planned enrollment. And this is also regulated against the plan that would have been signed off for each TVET college. I think it's interesting to note that by the time the enrollment numbers are reconciled in the year when we have done all the verifications and the evidence and so forth, the cross-checking, we find that enrollments are higher than what we, as the enrollment process is unfolded. In 2020, for example, by the time the year was concluded and the numbers were verified, there were notable over-enrollments in several colleges. And we have to manage that for 2021. We've put processes in place to manage that. because if we don't, then it obviously results in funding deficits. So that is just the background to the slides that I am going to go to. We have a slide on each one of the regions. We might not have to really speak to all the figures in all the slides, but it might be useful to look at what these slides are telling us in terms of the numbers. And the first one up is Limpopo. And perhaps to give a little bit of explanation of what this means with reference to the trends and patterns that we see in certain colleges. So we have in Limpopo the seven colleges listed there. We have 7 TVET colleges, but with many sites of delivery in of our regions. So kept on referring to the two plan target and the first column, that is everything. The SEE, the NATED program, enrollments, our centers of specialization, target enrollments for students who will be enrolled in programs that are undertaken in partnership with peers or for which the colleges have received National Skills Fund funding to do certain kinds of skills training. Especially in the post-pandemic period. So all of that comes into, that's a composite figure. And those are planned. They are highly disaggregated in the enrollment plan that the colleges do. Now the total achieved is the interesting column. That is what the colleges have indicated, the applications that they have received and that the students that have been registered as at now. As they submitted these figures late last week. Now, one would expect there to be a high correlation between the first two columns, but that's not the case. And really it shouldn't be, because as I've indicated, the numbers for semester two, for example, the trimester two, trimester three, and so forth have yet to come when those enrollments take place. The students who have yet to enroll from the for example, where the results were released yesterday and we applied to colleges, there has to be space for them to enroll. Now, Capricorn College, as first college, there's a very interesting case to point out, and that will be set against Sekukuni down the line. Now, Capricorn, we know, is what we consider to be an urban college in Limpopo. All is high demand, early enrolled. 2 years ago, we will recall we had to shift the enrollment process to a stadium because students were being bused there in thousands and created a problem. So clearly, it's a high demand area. The college has had 10,428, and at the moment, they have already enrolled 9,342. A concern, the college and the department are going to have to watch because they could run into problems down the line for the subsequent trimesters and semesters. And they still have 28, close to 29,000 pending applications. Now, what that tells us is that against their planned target, they will not be able to accept many of those, well, just about all of those students. So they have far, far more applications they have to take. The last column that speaks pending registrations, other students have actually been accepted. They have been, they have jumped through all hoops, they have satisfied all the requirements, they have been informed, they can register, but for various reasons, as in some colleges, they not confirmed the registration, so it has not translated to an actual registration. So this is what the figures tell us, this is the way we see it for all the slides. Now if we use the same slide to look at a page like Suku down line, we have, it's a slow college, it's a rural college. No, Tandi, it's the same slide, thank you. It's a rural college, and they have a planned target of 6,144, again, a composite target. But as of now, they have 2,825 confirmed registrations. The fact that they do not have any pending applications means they have processed all of them. And there are no pending registrations, which means the students who applied have come and confirmed their registrations. So the clue here is that the applications are very slow. There's a smaller turnout of young people to register at the college, and the college has to more aggressively go out and recruit the young people. But it could all mean that we have a system to take students in trimesters 2-3 and in semester 2, which a college Capricorn would not be able to do because it has matched its enrollment target and has which have to be sufficient. So Kukuni could be an e-pay college users will spread the figures out for another nation's enrollment. They will be their target and they'd be comfortable. Or the end, we could find them there. So the bidding that we track the soft enrollment and colleges, unlike universities and in schools, enrollments happen throughout the year at different times. So, you know, it's an engine, a wealth engine that continues throughout the year. If we move to the next slide, it's the same thing. Certain region, the state and Gauteng region is largest of the six regions. It is made up of 12 colleges, and some of the biggest colleges because Gauteng colleges are larger. If we look south, Gauteng College with 20,887 total enrollment is the largest that we have as a total enrolled. Really the largest college, Swane North is a very big college in the Swane municipality, and the other colleges are, you know, pretty much 5,000 and above. So it's a very region counted over 178,000 total plan enrollment for the year. The Free State Goldfields College, as you can see, is a smallish college with their total plan sitting at 3,585, and yes, in the spread of colleges, that is the lowest. If we look at Mateo College in the Free State, big difference between Mateo and Mateo. Mateo is a large college, the Free State in Bloemfontein, and they too, like I pointed out, Tricon is voluminous applications. They still have 22,000 pending applications, but today they have confirmed 8,655. So this is just an indication of the dynamic whilst enrolls are unfolding in the TVET colleges. The trends, as I said, the different figures tell us, the trends in the different regions and how the colleges manage them. We have to guard against over-enrollment and there's the potential of under-enrollment. So we move to the next slide. I suppose the questions can be after the end, depending on the interest that the honourable members have to specific regions or provinces or where the colleges are located in different districts and so forth, rather than spending a huge amount of time on dealing with them individually. The Eastern Cape is also interesting, in that the pending applications, as we can see, are rather low. They are able to process because, again, applications, the tendency in the Eastern Cape is that students tend to register rather late. It's very slow, very tardy, and it tends to drag on. So that's a dynamic we have to manage constantly in the Eastern Cape. As the applications come in, they are processed. That is why we don't have several pending applications, because there isn't the influx that we get in, for example, Gauteng. Buffalo City is clearly one of the colleges that gets high enrollment, so they are able to start off with a substantial number. But if we look at a college like King Hensa, it still has to build up its numbers even at this stage, because the applications to these colleges do not come in, thick and fast compared to the others. If we look at the Mpumalanga Northwest here, this pretty much gives us what would be more or less a normal picture. This is what we should be seeing by and large, except with Taleso, where we are still seeing pending applications are higher than they should be. But with regard to the other colleges, it's pretty much a picture that gives us a sense that the registrations are proceeding in a normal way. The Northern Cape and Western Cape also more or less a normal picture, except that we have a few corrections here, Chair. The changes were made, but I don't see why it's not reflected here. Perhaps it was too late. The North Link, South Cape, and West Coast, they don't correspond to the figures there. The 10,547 should actually be West Coast. And the 23,794 is Northlink, which is the largest college in the province. And West Coast should be the, South Cape. South Cape should have been 7,477 and West Coast 10,547. So those last three colleges, they somehow got garbled, because Northlink is the largest college, South Cape is the smallest, and the middle of the road there is South Cape. So my apologies for that. It was picked up very late that they were mixed up. So here, what should be the norm as we go through these slides is if the total achieved, the second column is more or less 50 to 60%. Of what the total plan target is, it shouldn't be cause for much alarm given where we are now in the year and the figures we are dealing with. It should be more or less what we ought to expect. First of all, as the current numbers settle, enrollments in the first enrollments of the year, the first trimester, the first semester, and of course the annual program is usually higher. It thins out in the latter part of the year. By the time all the numbers are verified and the reconciliations are done, they go up much higher, substantially higher. And then the numbers from the alternate programs that are not funded, from the subsidies, by the time those get added, that is how the colleges actually report on these projected targets. So just at a very high level, that should be the trends that we are looking at. The last slide here, Chair, is KZN, which came in a bit late. And I must say, we just snuck it in yesterday. So I haven't had a chance to really interrogate them seriously. But KZN, again, a big province with 9 colleges and over 94,000 planned enrollments. The largest of our colleges here is, strangely enough, Majuba College, which is an inland college, and they too reach their targets very early, and they've got to manage the enrollments in the subsequent learning period. If we can move to the next one, Chandi. Here we just have a snapshot. Unfortunately here, because the KZN submission came in late, it does not include the KZN figures. If we add the 94,000 to the total planned target, you can see that it would be about 500 and just over 530,000. And that is exactly what we would commit to in our APPs going forward for
for
next financial, or for the current academia. In terms of challenges, we just have a snapshot of the challenges that we can report in the enrollment process as it has unfolded up to now. Tandy, can we move to that one? It's a shortish slide. We found that prospective students do struggle with the online applications. Some do not have devices or data. I just to clarify that when it comes to online applications, it's not just about students sitting wherever they are and doing online applications. To give traction to this process, what we have done is, or what the colleges have done, is allow students to come to the colleges and do their online applications in the college, just so that this whole concept of online applications becomes, you know, familiar to students, first of all, so they are assisted in doing the online applications in the institutions. And then it helps the colleges to also build up their online application system with, capturing the data and systematizing it and so forth. So a lot of the applications, the students are assisted with doing them on-site in the colleges. Then there are those who are assisted with doing them at home or on their devices, including on their phones and so forth. So there are different ways in which they are supported to go online and do these applications, but there's still a struggle, especially those students who come from deep rural locations. What is very common is that students do not submit all of their required documents upfront. So, doing the verification and the scoring of the candidates or applicants, becomes pretty much a back and forth process, and that takes a long time. That is why the admission process tends to not get completed within the predetermined time frame that we set always. We try to keep them tight, but invariably we have to provide a little bit of leeway for the process to be completed. For example, this year we had to extend it by another week. In the grander scheme of things, it's necessary for us to do. I alluded to this earlier on, that some students did not actually confirm their provisional registration. They were provisionally registered, but they did not come back and confirm their registration. So that forms part of what we saw in the slide as pending. And provisionally registered students also do not complete all the steps. We have essentially four steps, the application, and then the evaluation, and then the offer, and then the actual registration. There are four steps. And some of them do not go through all of the steps. Somewhere along the way, they fall off. And despite the call for online applications, that is where we want to go, and we are driving it very hard, is there are still high volumes of walk-ins by prospective students. And that is why this time of the year is very much a difficult time, for colleges having to manage multiple processes at this stage to finalize and to begin classes and so forth. So it's quite a challenging time. The last slide, Chair, is just deals with the registration still as part of the challenges. Obviously, we are in a period where there was late release of results, both in the TVET colleges. As I said, those results were only released on the 5th of February, which is different from previous years when it's released early in January. But this, of course, has been the knock-on effect of the pandemic, because the exams stretched way into December. As we know, we struggled with the pandemic in the December-January period when the marking had to happen, and that delayed the results. But all things considered, it really panned out very well. In fact, that the results were released early in February for all of the exams were written in December is actually a success, and it was declared so by Uma Lucy. We have low enrollment numbers as it stands at the moment for the national certificates and the pre-vocational learning programs. They are not of real concern, because the aim is not to have very high numbers in national certificates. We are looking at post-matric TVET colleges being positioned for the post-matric programs and the pre-vocational learning programs that should support those learners who do not have the basics, you know, the learning foundations. So if the demand isn't great, it means we are getting better students, better quality of students, and colleges are more selective now. The there has been delayed registration by returning students, those who were registered, and some students withdrew because of the fears, especially in January around the COVID-19 pandemic. They felt that they would rather wait for a later trimester or a later semester or such like. And the good news is that some of the students were admitted at universities, a small number. They didn't come back, but that is, I would say, a positive outcome if students did get accepted in the end at universities. In terms of NSFAS, we found that the delayed funding for the 2021 applications caused some apprehension among students, because if their funding was not confirmed for 2021, they could not be certain that they were able to actually register. And these affected students whose 2020 application funding status was not clear or confirmed. We found that the second trimester students in 2020, those funding decisions were largely outstanding last year, and something we are dealing with NSFAS. So that has a knock-on effect on the 2021 enrollments for those particular students, not generally, but just for those students whose funding was not cleared in the second trimester of 2020. And then across colleges, because of the high volumes that we're logging on, there were challenges reported by colleges for the online portal, and there was a clogging of the system, and there was a great deal of downtime, and because of that, it also drove the walk-in applications quite high. But of course, we have been already addressing many of these issues with NSFAS. With that, I thank you, Honorable Chair. That brings me to the end of my presentation. Tandi, I would assume, are you going to do the NSFAS presentation? Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Aruna. I have seen that there are NSFAS senior executives in the portfolio committee, and I wanted to know if they wanted an opportunity. There's just three slides that we wanted to present on NSFAS, and I don't want to take the opportunity.
Andy and Aruna, because it'll take a long time, actually. Okay.
So we'll just quickly rush through the last slides, Minister, then. And the NSFAS colleagues will be around to answer questions if necessary. This slide provides you with a sense of how the application process works for NSFAS. It's really quite useful. I guess people will be able to also refer to it later, but it shows how the student applies for NSFAS and the validations are built in, and the electronic validation process. There's a case management process which ensures that all the correct documentation is available, and then applications are validated against the eligibility criteria, and student accounts are created, and then there's a match with the process of a student applying to university and TVET, because a student is only a NSFAS student if they qualify on the financial eligibility criteria, and then once they are registered for an approved program in an approved institution, and then those two things are linked through the data exchange process with the institution. So that gives you an overview of that process. Just in terms of, I'm just trying to get to the next slide. I don't know why it's not coming. Apologies, I've been muted and I can't move my slides. But let me just try and get to that slide so that I can present to you what the applications look like. As the Minister had indicated, we had enormous numbers of applications. As expected, a 25% increase in the applications for NSFAS received in 2020 for the 2021 academic year. In fact, 799,017 applications were received by NSFAS. That includes the online applications as well as the NYDA and TVET walk-ins. Maybe just to indicate, these are applications that represent the huge aspiration for post-school education and training, but not necessarily all of those students would qualify, and not necessarily all of them would obtain a space. You can see that the online channel achieved a very high number of applications, the vast majority of applications coming through the online channel, and also an increase in the use of the online methodology for applications. The Minister has already mentioned the 67% of the new applications being SASSA beneficiaries. Maybe an important trend for us to discuss at some stage. The majority of the applications have already been processed and evaluated by NSFAS, and all the evaluations will hopefully complete by the end of February. This is in line with the timing of the new start of the new academic year, as well as the release of the NSC results. And NSFAS has introduced an improvement which allows students to immediately appeal when they have been rejected, so that those appeals can be processed quickly and any change decisions can be processed at an early point in the academic year. NSFAS is really trying to speed that process up. In terms of the new funding decisions, NSFAS is ready to make provisional funding decisions and will confirm funding once students obtain firm offers. Also, we need to manage the risk of unfunding students at a later stage, which has happened in previous years, and the new funding decisions will be communicated following the release of the NSC results and once students have received offers and firm places. In terms of continuing students, NSFAS has been in a position to fund students who are continuing where they have already registered, where their academic results have been received, but also there has been a chance taken to use the extended period to firm up the processes, so that once the results are all submitted, from now on, there will be a smooth process to verify the continuing students' results and to allow those students to proceed with their necessary funding. The supplementary results have been coming in based on the work that is happening at institutions, but some students will have been already confirmed for funding if their academic year has already commenced. Thank you very much, Chairperson. That's the end of our presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Can I now hand over to DBE Deputy Minister? DM?
Yes, Chair. I thought maybe, but if the Minister has already left, it's okay, because I thought that we'll take the presentation of higher education, then we come to basic education. But if the Minister is gone already, because the officials are going to sit for the duration of the meeting, we can take the presentation of basic education. Yes.
Minister, are you still in the meeting?
Yes, Chair, I'm still in the meeting. I thought if there are one or two questions I could take before I ask to be excused, I'd be more than happy to do so. Those that are direct.
Oh, okay. No, I thought you left already. No, it's fine then.
But the rest of the team will remain.
All right. No, it's fine. Members, can I, that's the presentation then from Department of Higher Education. Can I note 10? Exactly. I don't know whose iPad. There is an iPad, and then there's Honorable Ngobo, and then there's Chair of Higher Education. I don't know who is this. It's just an iPad. There's no name. Can you just say? tell us who you are, Honourable Member? Okay, the hand is removed. Babu Ngobo, can I hand over to yourself then? And then after that, the Chair of Higher Education will also have a bite.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. It's just one very simple question. It's in connection with the certification backlog. Not so much interest. Am I not audible, Chair? Let me switch on the video.
Yes, please.
Yes. Can you hear me now, Chairperson? Am I fine now, Chair?
Yes.
Oh, thank you very much. My question is on the TVET colleges, the backlog in certification. I know that the department currently and in the past has had a lot of problems with coping with regards to the this backlog. But I'm interested in knowing. Just a poll figure, approximately. I know that the minister might not be having it with him in his hands right now. But how bad is the situation right now? But the question I am more interested in is, currently as we move, are we able now to cope with issuing certificates whilst the backlog is being addressed? Thank you very much. That was my question.
Honorable Mapulane?
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let's welcome and thank the department for the presentation. I only have a comment and a question, maybe two questions. And I think from our side, we must welcome the announcement that there's been a negotiation in relation to the tuition and accommodation fees across the system, which will be implemented this academic year. I think that is a breakthrough given the fact that the issue around fees is normally what disturbs the commencement of the academic year. And would appreciate that even in the question of the fees must fall, the trigger was around the increase in the tuition fees. So the fact that the department was able to negotiate the framework, I think it's something that must be welcome because it will contribute towards ensuring that there is stability, especially at the beginning of the 2021 academic year, which is expected to be mid-March. So I think that is a very welcome development. My question is on UNISA. And I think maybe we can link this question around the enrollment plans with the increased applications for funding that NSFAS has received. Now, I would like the department to further elaborate on this almost additional 20,000 that has to be taken off the enrollment plan of UNISA. Maybe to elaborate a bit on it, if there is any background to this, what has led UNISA to operate and to enroll more students than what has been approved in terms of the enrollment plan, and what will be the impact of this to some of the students who might have been already admitted or been communicated that they will be admitted to study for certain degree programs at UNISA. Linked to this, to the question of the enrollment plan, I note that there is about 184,315 for the undergraduate programs, which will be funded. What is the relationship between this number and the number of students who are applying for NSFAS to be admitted? We know that the funding decisions for NSFAS is dependent on the student being admitted to study whatever programs offered by the university or the TVET college. But what will be the relationship between this number and the number that gets to apply to NSFAS, because there has to be a correlation between the number of studying opportunities available at universities and TVET, this number is specifically for universities, and the amount that the student, the number of students that NSFAS can fund. Otherwise, those would be my question. Thank you very much.
Honorable Masabela.
According to Development and Enterprise, South Africa is about fit to have 456,000 by 2025. So, and while the country produces about 15,000 new teachers each year, it loses between 18,000 and 22,000 teachers who leave the profession every year. So, Chairperson, what is the confusion that there is a risk that too many teachers will be produced in areas where an oversupply already exists? Then the second question, which is the last one. Since universities have institutional autonomy, how do we ensure that university enrollment for teacher education programs is informed by the country developmental needs and scientifically based? Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Masabela. I don't see a hand, and in an absence of that, maybe, Minister, let me give to you then to lead the responses.
Yes, thank you very much, Chair. I'm just going to make some initial responses, and then I will leave the officials to provide a bit more detail, especially where it's required. To Honorable Ngobo, indeed, I don't have the figures. Maybe the officials may be able to tell us in terms of outstanding certificates, TVET college certificates. All I want to say is that this matter, we're dealing with as a department, but I am still unhappy as a minister that there is still even a single outstanding certificate. I've said this openly, that we are not worth the name of being a Department of Education if we can't issue certificates. I'm doing my best to push on this matter with my officials to make sure that we actually eliminate all these backlogs. I've raised this matter very sharply with the Director General and my unhappiness on this matter, and I'm not going to hide it. And I feel that we can push more to be able to do better, because we are doing an injustice, frankly, to TVET college graduates who can't get their certificates on time. Ideally, the turnaround for a certificate should be not more than 3 months once you have finished. So that's what I want to say. I am pushing, and it's correct for the portfolio committees to be hard on this matter. On UNISA, I think that perhaps also Tandi can give a bit more detail about this. Usually the arrangement is that we don't want students who are already in the system to be negatively affected. They must continue, those who are meeting the criteria to continue. We do that across all our institutions, even in relation to those who are supported by NSFAS. We have to protect by all means, even in the light of this huge application, we have to protect by all means those who are already in the system. So should be the case with UNISA. The other thing that we haven't done, which we are still going to do, it's always a challenge for us because we have to wait until the matric results are announced before we start doing any work, is to analyze these matric results and what do they mean. What implications do they have for NSFAS, for our post-school education and training institutions, for our system, the PSET system as a whole? We always do this at this time so that we ourselves are going to come out and say what are the implications of this. Contrary to what some of our detractors normally say, we do care about all the students, including UNISA students. But part of caring about our students is that we can't allow registration beyond what is allowed. If a hotel has got 60 rooms, it's got 60 rooms. The challenge we have is to expand the post-school education and training system, in particular the TVET college system, which in the end is going to be our solution to so many young people, many of whom are sitting at home. But you can't have a system without enrollment planning. It's as simple as all that. In fact, it was irresponsible of UNISA. I want to put that quite openly. I've spoken to senior management. It was irresponsible for UNISA to actually do over-enrollment. They knew exactly the implications of that, not just for UNISA, but just for the system as a whole. I'm pleased to say that in my discussions with the new vice chancellor, we had an understanding that UNISA would have to do this thing and manage it, because it's actually about them. All what we are doing, we are just enforcing enrollment plans for all institutions. It's not that we are actually targeting UNISA. But the reason why we are raising this with UNISA is because UNISA went beyond the limitations, which was irresponsible. I must say that no institution must be able to do that and get away with it, because they know the havoc they are causing in the system and to themselves. The other thing about UNISA, Chair, I know some people do not like it when I raise this, but it's a fact. The pass rate at UNISA is shockingly low. If there is one area, I mean, Tandi can be able to give us the statistics. You can't be in such a situation and still be going beyond the numbers that we are able to afford as a system, when in fact also your pass rate is so low. In fact, if there is one priority for UNISA, is to increase the pass rate more than any other thing as a priority. We are not for exclusion. It's correct if members are saying, like the chairperson, Honorable Mapulana, is asking, it's the right question that he's asking. What implications will this have for UNISA to stick to what has been agreed upon for teacher training, for instance, and for other things? UNISA itself will have to look into that and tell us that. What we are doing as a department is to say the system can afford 187,000 new entrants.
And we expect every university to stick to that without fail. So it's very important that we actually say that, and that it's got nothing to do with the minister's negative attitude towards UNISA or minister not caring about access, you know, of students to the... It's of no use to have access to FAPE. It's a very important issue that I think as members of parliament, we also have to be quite firm about that. Thank you very much, Chair. I will just allow then the officials, perhaps if they want to come in with a bit more details and some figures, they may have them better than I have them at the moment. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Minister. Anyone from the officials? Linda?
Chair, can I come in? It's Aruna.
Okay, fine.
Okay, Chair, I can speak to the certification backlog. Actually, it's the latest report which we'll be tabling this afternoon. We do fortnightly meetings to track the certification backlog. And just the context, last year in March 2020, we made a commitment to the Portfolio Committee on Higher Education that we would eradicate the certification backlog by 31 March this year. And that's what we have been working towards. So the report as at today, the 23rd of March, we have for the meeting today, is we have the business studies standing at 99.04%, the engineering studies at 90.33%, the NCV, which we call first issues, 99.27%, and the NCV full certificates at 97.58%. And the GETC is where the focus is right now. ABIT level 4 is at 87.62%, so that gives us an overall standing of 91.44%. So we have made significant inroads, Chair, and we have committed and confident that the target would have been reached by 31 March this year, as we promised. Just to indicate also, CETA is not here. We work with CETA in eradicating the backlog. The question is, are we coping at the moment with meeting the turnaround times of 3 months? And the answer is yes. Since last year, the certificates are being issued for the exams that are current within a period of 3 months. That's what we have committed to on our strat plans. Remember, these backlogs date back to 1992. So to conclude them, you know, on per learner unit records is what has taken so long, because we've had to go back deep into our records to reconcile those records. So just to indicate that we are very within the very close range of meeting the target within the next month. But in the same breath, I want to record, Chair, that CETA is not here. As I said, we work closely with them. And 2 weeks ago, we just lost the project manager for the certification backlog, Mr. Vernon John at CETA. He project led this activity, worked extremely hard, and unfortunately, 2 weeks ago, we lost him to cardiac arrest. But CETA is continuing with the work, and we continue to work with them, and we remain committed to the target. Thank you very much.
Chairperson, this is Tandy. I can come in on some of the university questions, and as also guided by the minister on some areas where I should give additional responses. Just in terms of, and maybe to answer the latter question about autonomy and the enrollment planning and link that to the UNISA issue, I mean, precisely this issue of autonomy precisely we have the enrollment plan so that we are able to negotiate in terms of a system compact, and it is critical that institutions are part of that, sort of fully part of that compact. There are there are methods in which there are methodologies to penalize institutions if they do overall under-enroll significantly. In fact, the benchmark is normally around 2% of the enrollment plan, because enrollment planning is not an exact science. There are often going to be reasons for deviations at institutions. But that's what's so important about the enrollment planning, because the university the university enrollment plans are informed by the developmental needs of the country. They are informed by the scarce skills requirements. They are informed also by the university's own capacity and infrastructure requirements, etc. And they are, of course, linked to the funding of the system. So maybe just to say that, and maybe just to also clarify the question also asked by the honourable member. In terms of the production of teachers, of educators through the system, there isn't an attempt to reduce the numbers of students that are coming out of the system in the teacher education area, but really the focus is on working with universities to ensure that we're able to produce teachers more into the areas of specialized skill that are required for the schooling system. And so that requires working with the education deans. It requires support for the development of teacher education programs in specific areas. And it's also something that is stimulated through, for example, the areas of specialization that are supported through the Phundzile Shaka bursary. But I think my colleagues in DBSE would be able to give more information on that. Maybe also to say that the applications at NSFAS and the link between the spaces, it does look out of sync. Maybe just to highlight that the applications that NSFAS receives, on the one hand, they represent aspiration. So those are students who would wish to go into post-school education and training. They're not all students that would go to university. Many of them would go into the TVET colleges. And some may not succeed and may end up in doing other kinds of activities and other opportunities. But those students also include applications from students who are already in the system, perhaps already students where their financial circumstances have changed. So that's also perhaps why we're seeing an increase in this year in particular, is just given the socioeconomic effects of the pandemic. And then just in terms of UNISA specifically, but again, as the Minister has indicated very clearly, we're not just talking about UNISA, we're talking about every single institution in the system. And in a sense, we're talking about, on the one hand, a codependency on the amount of funding that's available in the system that has to be carefully managed, both in terms of the fiscal constraints, the amount of funding that is available for the system, the need to maintain stability in the system, and the need to ensure quality provision so that students are not coming into the system and then immediately going out. What I wanted to say, is that the point that the Minister made about the throughput, the UNISA throughput rates are significantly lower than those of other institutions in the system, but and their throughput rate is about 26%. Is significantly lower than the other institutions on average. Of course, on the one hand, one would expect that with an institution such as UNISA, where there are students that are employed and are studying part-time. But even when one takes the distance nature and open learning nature of UNISA's teaching into account, we are still very, very concerned about the throughput and the dropout rate. And then maybe just so we are really, really trying to work with UNISA on that. And the university has, also responded and recognized that there's a need to focus on that. Also the fact that a number of students get taken into new kind of higher certificate programs, there's a big focus also on ensuring that when we take students into those first-time entering programs, that there are actually opportunities for them to articulate into the workplace and articulate into 3-year degrees and diplomas, depending on the nature of the program. But it is also important that institutions, when they're introducing new programs, that those programs are actually articulated with the opportunities for further study and for jobs. And so there's quite a lot of focus that we are also putting on that with UNISA. But then just in terms of the numbers, just to give you a sense of why the enrollment plan is also a 6-year process. significantly in 2018, which was the first year of the new bursary scheme. And indeed, we know that the pressure on institutions has been significant since the introduction of the fully subsidized funding. However, what the problem was at UNISA that they didn't implement a proper enrollment management system, which is something they are currently working on. And unfortunately, also in 2020, they over-enrolled significantly by over 20,000 students in 2020 alone. Those students are now in the system. They have to be carried through, both in terms of the subsidy funding that's provided to UNISA, as well as in terms of the NISFA funding. And so you can see the kind of effect. So the reduction in enrollments, as much as it appears to be a one-year off event, if you look at the enrollment plan over the six-year period, it's really about trying to balance the enrollments at UNISA over that period so that they are affordable, the institution can remain sustainable, the system can remain sustainable, the teaching input units are not reduced at other institutions, and also that those students are provided and adequately supported to be successful. Hence, that's really what the problem is. And I think I've answered most of the questions. Minister, the only thing I didn't do at your request is to just clarify on the issue of the NISFA circular, which had been appearing in the media over the last couple of days. And maybe just to clarify, I know the NISFA colleagues are here if there are any further questions to be answered, but just to clarify from the department side, NISFA did release a circular on the 12th of February, where they were referring to legacy qualifications in the university system. These are qualifications that were offered at universities that are not aligned to the new HQSF, the qualifications framework. Most of those qualifications have been phased out in institutions. The two points of clarity are, number one, as much as there were qualifications like the B.Ed mentioned in that communication, the B.Ed is our main teacher education qualification, and it is a funded qualification. What they were referring to was the old qualifications, which had the same name. The second issue is that obviously students who are pipeline students, who happen to be already on those programs that are being phased out within institutions, those students, as long as they qualify academically and otherwise in terms of NISFAS criteria, would continue to be funded. I know that NISFAS has released a clarificatory circular and media release on this, and I hope that will gain some traction in the media so that we can alleviate the confusion that was caused by that. Thank you, Minister. Thank you, Chairperson.
Minister, are you covered? Are you fine?
Yes, I'm fine. If you are okay, I'm okay.
All right. No, we are okay. I think we are okay, Minister, because I don't see any other hand from the honorable members. And probably let us thank you, Minister, and your entourage for honoring the invite and giving us this presentation on the admission. It's still the enrollment is still having a lot of challenges in our country, in our constituencies. Now, since the matric results yesterday night, we are inundated with calls. You know, parents, I don't know, they still believe in doing things manually. This online thing, it's not working really with our parents in the rural areas. But anyway, thank you very much, Minister. I think we can release you, and we can release your entourage as well. As you are leaving, we'll then head over to the DM of Basic Education to lead the presentation of Basic Education.
Yep, and thanks for your understanding.
Thank you, Minister. All right.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you to higher education. I believe all of us have benefited. But what we can say, we do have a constant engagement with the university, with the Department of Higher Education. Like we indicated when we came to present about the readiness and also the results, that when we said the results would be out towards the end of February, which happened yesterday, and we also indicated that we had an agreement with the higher education and the universities that they will start their academic year around March, which is still the case. Our children will get space, will be admitted based on the results that were announced yesterday. I don't know, because when I look at the time, maybe we'll go beyond after 12 to 1, and if that is the case, it will be okay, though we start it early. But we really appreciate, and it's possible that two portfolio committees can meet, and other than to keep on waiting to say this department will go to that other one, and then, but it's a good thing that we brought the portfolio committee on higher education to this meeting today, so that we all benefit. And we also thank the members of the portfolio committee in higher education. Chair, maybe a brief remark that I can make is that the results of grade 12 are out, and there is a decline, of course, which I believe that we all anticipated the decline of about 5%. And we want to thank everyone, starting from the portfolio committee, the select committee, and everybody who helped the department, because the department alone could not have achieved anything and could not have schools open during the COVID-19, especially of 2020, where we all did not have an experience of what was expected at the time. We all relied on the Department of Health to give us guidance and set up the health protocols to be followed to address the COVID-19 pandemic. So, but under the circumstance, our children were able to pass. And we reported about the leakages, etc. But we are so happy that Umalusi looked at the matter, looked at our report, and pronounced the results as authentic. So we want to thank that. Chair, we have a slight challenge with our province, Northern Cape, which I believe that we need to work together to uplift the standard of Northern Cape. Northern Cape at some stage, Chair, used to obtain number one at some stage. So they must just go back. And always, all these years, Northern Cape was on the top four. It has never been down. So we need to help the province, and I know that the district that, not all the districts of course, but the one that is worse is your JTG. And I know that JTG is very far. So for politicians in the province and internationally to reach that district is a nightmare. So would encourage the MECs, all, not only MEC of Education in the Northern Cape, to support that district. Because even now, on the floods, it's declared a disaster. So it means that there are more challenges than only educational challenges. So we are going to work with them. Chair, another reason, remember we presented to the committee that we no longer continue with MEO. And at this class of 2020 is the first class to write that all the progress learners write the full examination. So in January, after analyzing the results in January of 2020, we saw this as a risk coming, because we celebrated a highest percentage ever that the country has never achieved before in basic education and the NSC. But we saw the challenge, the risk of the progress learners, that since there shall be no MEO, their performance might affect the performance of the entire nation.
We set up plans to help them, but unfortunately, COVID came and destroyed all our plans. And these students did not get a tailor-made support, a specific support for them. But we want to thank them that, be as it may, they, some of them were able to pass, and a sizable number of them did write, and more than 24,000 did pass, and some did pass with bachelor passes, and most of their pass is bachelor and diploma. Only about 11, I don't know exactly, but it's a small number of them that just got a senior certificate. So it tells that the system is shaping and is moving, that even despite the lack of the tailor-made support for the progress learners, they still progress beyond 2012. We really appreciate. So Chair, let me not take much of your time explaining this. We are with the DG who's struggling with his connectivity, but we have DDGs in the department. We have DDG Padiache, we have Carol Nuga, we have all the officials in the department. But if DG is still connected, I was trying to check if he's still connected. I want to hand over to him. If DG is not connected, then I'll give it to DG Padiache.
Thank you very much, DM. Mr. Padiache will lead the team on the two presentations. Thank you, Honorable Chair and Honorable Member. Thank you, DM. Mr. Padiache.
Thank you, DG. Thank you to DM. And good morning to the Honorable Chair and the Honorable Members. Our presentation on the NSFAS will be made by Mr. Gerrit Kutsia. And he's the Director for Initial Teacher Education. Gerrit.
Thank you very much, DDG, honorable members, honorable chairperson, honorable deputy minister, and the Minister of Higher Education. Thank you for the opportunity to do this presentation. I am going to share my screen, and if you can just indicate if you are able to see the presentation.
Yes, we can see it, Mr. Kutsia.
And then I just want to confirm, Chairperson, are you seeing two slides or only one slide?
One.
Only one slide. Thank you very much. I think the Deputy Minister has really set this presentation up very nicely with the remarks on the National Senior Certificate, because I think it's important to note that the results that we were able to achieve under very difficult and trying circumstances, those results were achieved by our teachers in the system who supported our learners, and they paid testimony and tribute to the level of resilience, innovation, and the depth of the knowledge and competence of our teachers. And many of our teachers that have been teaching in the National Senior Certificate or teaching National Senior Certificate learners are teachers that have graduated from our universities. And there may even be a few of them who have been funded through the Funza Lushaka bursary program. I think it's therefore important to just acknowledge that and also recognize that education quality and the performance of learners is a joint effort by many stakeholders. And in this case, it also includes the Department of Higher Education and Training, the different universities that are training teachers, as well as NSFAS that is assisting with the funding of teachers. Chairperson, and this is also echoed in the National Development Plan that puts the requirement before us as government that we as an education system should work together in supporting our learners. I'm going to focus in the next few slides talking a little bit about the role of NSFAS and how that the role is supported by the Department of Basic Education. And I think it's common knowledge that we know that NSFAS provides financial help through study bursaries to deserving students at public universities and TVET colleges. For the purpose of this presentation, I'm going to focus more on public universities. The Department of Basic Education supports NSFAS to strengthen, increase its footprint and improve advocacy, especially in high schools and in the grades 10 to 12. And one of the ways in which we are doing that is by publishing the contact information for applications in the National Senior Certificate timetable. We also provide briefings to provincial heads of education departments, and our national teacher centers also make available spaces where learners can lodge applications for NSFAS. And then we envisage that through the life orientation subject that more information will be able to get into the classroom, where the life orientation teacher can facilitate and share the information on how to apply for NSFAS, who qualifies for NSFAS, and assist with the application process. For a very long time, we've had in fact, since the inception of the Funza Lushaka bursary program, it was agreed that NSFAS will be appointed to do the financial administration of the Funza Lushaka bursary program. This is also then articulated in a memorandum of agreement, and it is guided by the Funza Lushaka policy. We've established a number of accountability platforms to monitor progress, which includes monthly and operational meetings, quarterly reporting, as well as annual Funza Lushaka meetings that we have with all stakeholders. This slide speaks about the interface in the business process between NSFAS and the Department of Basic Education. And we know that we receive a earmarked allocation from National Treasury on the 1st of April for the Funza Lushaka bursary program, which then gets transferred to NSFAS that will administer the funding of students at universities, teacher education students. Now, step three is extremely important because it deals with the Funza Lushaka application processes and the selection processes. I'm going to pause just for a few moments at this step and also speak a little bit about how COVID-19 has impacted on this particular step in the business process. Honorable members may be aware that the closing date for Funza Lushaka applications historically has been always the first Friday in January of every year. But because of the impact of COVID-19 on the schooling system as well as the higher education system, we had to postpone and lengthen the application period to the 28th of February, which will now be the closing date for Funza Lushaka applications in 2021. And this is similarly that we do in the past, where we close it a few days after the release of the matric results. We do the same this year as well. So it will allow our national senior certificate candidates who have just received their results as well to now apply for the Funza Lushaka Bursary Program. That will, however, have a knock-on effect on our selection process, and that leads to step four in this business process, because what makes Funza Lushaka different to what Thandi has explained to us earlier around the NSFAS process is that it is extremely important for the basic education sector that the students we fund through Funza Lushaka stick with the subjects that they have chosen, as well as the phase of schooling that they have chosen. And we can only pin that down after registration. Historically, we have found that a student will apply for one area, and when they register, they actually register for something else, which then leads to supply problems later on in the value chain when we want to employ such Funza Lushaka graduate. In step five, the student is now registered, they've been selected for Funza Lushaka. The university can now submit the claim to NSFAS, and the disbursement of funds can happen from NSFAS to the student as well as the university. Step six, together with the higher education institutions, we monitor the students, the Funza Lushaka bursary holders, and this step repeats itself. Step one to six repeats itself in every year of study that a student is registered for a Bachelor's of Education, and ultimately, hopefully by the end of the fourth year, when they've completed the Bachelor of Education, there's a process of placement that takes place in public schools in South Africa. This is just a summary of the process, and it just shows how the different stakeholders, the different role players, work together in ensuring the Funza Lushaka Bursary Program achieves its objectives and is implemented properly. I think this is important just to share with the honourable members. There was a question earlier from honourable Machete, who spoke about the enrolment plans for higher education and the needs that we have for teachers in our schools. Now, what is important to note on this particular slide is that in terms of enrollment in 2018 for the BEd and PGCE, at that point, at the end of 2018, there were 150,431 students in the pipeline. Some of these students would have included the Funza Lushaka bursary holders as well. So Funza Lushaka would make up about 13,500 of that 150,000 as enrolled pipeline students in 2018. Also at the end of 2018, it has to be noted that there were 28,203 graduates. In other words, those were newly qualified teachers that was able to enter the schooling system and to start their teaching careers. That is about 5,000 more graduates than what we have planned earlier in terms of our targets together with the Department of Higher Education. And what this slide therefore tells us is that at the moment, we are producing enough teachers. However, we fully agree with what Thandi have shared in the higher education presentation, and that is that we need to work together to ensure that we do not just produce more teachers, but that we produce teachers for the subject areas where there is a need, but also very importantly produce teachers for the emerging subject specializations that is emerging in the basic education sector through, for example, the three streams model, through increased emphasis on inclusive education, as well as ensuring that the subjects for the fourth industrial revolution is adequately catered for in our teacher graduates, new teacher graduates. This slide, I would like to emphasize just the one part, and that is the pie graph that deals with UNISA and others. Because, honorable members, in 2018, you would note that there were approximately just over 12,172 graduates, initial teacher education graduates from UNISA. And if you compare that with the 16,000 graduates that are produced by the 23 other public education institutions, then one can see there's a sizable footprint at UNISA, which have both positive aspects to it, but also some cautions that we just need to keep in mind. So one of the cautions that I would like to highlight is that if we suddenly close the tap at UNISA, it may, around teacher education production, it will have an impact on teacher supply in the basic education sector. So it has to be done carefully and definitely in consultation with the basic education sector. The second point on the positive side is that if we are able to strengthen quality at UNISA, it will definitely have a strong impact in terms of quality in the basic education sector. Now I'm just going to share a few slides on the Funza Lushaka bursary program, basically mostly reporting, but starting off looking at what is our 2021 policy imperatives. And as the Department of Higher Education have shared their presentation, we will also be guided by the way that COVID-19 unfolded in the year, and the Funza Lushaka administration may have to adjust and adapt to the changes that is dictated by the virus that cannot be predicted, and the impact that it will have on the higher education sector if such changes happen. I've spoken about the priority that we are placing on inclusive education, the fourth industrial revolution, and the fact that we are embracing the fact that we need to produce and support teachers through the Funza Lushaka bursary program that will live and work in the 21st century. Funza Lushaka was not excluded from the austerity measures that are being implemented across government and across the medium-term expenditure framework. The Funza Lushaka bursary program will receive 100 million less per year. Roughly speaking, and I'm emphasizing roughly, it probably translates to about 1,000 bursaries less that can be awarded per year. And this slide just takes that a little bit further. And I would like to just emphasize that we are targeting in 2020-21 still to be awarding 12,000 bursaries to students. The teaching specializations that have been communicated, and this is also what is available when students apply for Funza Lushaka bursary program, these teaching specializations also then correspond and articulate well with the policy directives that we've set out for ourselves. Just a quick reflection on what happened in 2020. We currently have 13,085 students that are completing, and I'm saying they are completing because the academic year at a number of institutions have not completed yet, and so we have to wait for these students to complete as well. We received in 2020 just over 60,000 applications, and so Funza Lushaka is still able to attract great interest among young people in South Africa. This is just showing our progress and our efforts to strengthen the awarding of bursaries to the primary school, in both the foundation phase and the intermediate phase. This is quite important. We are targeting youth below the age of 30. This is in line with the directive that we have received from the Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation, with a focus on youth. And it's also in line with the vision of the department to ensure that the teachers in our schools have a youthful face. And we all know that we are at the moment have, I think the average age of our teachers is around 47 years. So it's good to have more younger people coming into our schools. We most of our bursaries are going to the Black African community. That's rightfully so, in order to meet the requirements of our schools. The same with gender. 66% of our females bursaries gets awarded to female students, and so we are in line with that in terms of the broader governmental imperative. In terms of our project-based recruitment that is focusing on quintile 1 to 3 schools, we were able to avail 621 bursaries to students from through this particular project in 2020, and we look forward to increasing that in 2021, that number. The next few slides will be focusing on placement, and this slide just shows that we are starting to see our district-based recruited students going back to the communities and schools from where they are recruited. So in terms of placement, this is starting to happen, and we are monitoring this particular process. The placement trends shows that we've averaged between 90 and 85% over the years in terms of Funza Lushaka bursary graduates being placed in public schools. And in 2020, we are standing at 82% in terms of placement progress that have been made. Just in conclusion, and this is also just to echo what was earlier presented by our colleagues from the Department of Higher Education, the importance of enrollment planning to ensure that we produce teachers that will be able to take up service in those subjects in the basic education sector. Chairperson, this is my concluding slides. Thank you very much for the opportunity, and Mr. Pariachi is welcome to add if I've left anything else. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
The next presentation, please.
Thank you, DM. The next presentation on the SONA is Dr. Stephen Taylor.
Thank you. Over to you, Dr. Taylor.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Chairperson, Deputy Minister, Honourable Members. Let me just flight my screen, if I may. Should be seeing it in a moment. Let me just make it full screen mode. Okay. So this presentation is on BRSONA and looking at it from the perspective of basic education to take note of any implications for us as a sector and as a department. We've done this for the past few years. In the presentation, there are three main sections. In the first section, I'll briefly go through just the significance of BRSONA and how it fits into our planning and government. Secondly, a bit of analysis of the BRSONA, as well as linked to that, just a reminder of some of the main themes coming through in recent BRSONAs. And then lastly, given that the main focus in this year's BRSONA, in particular as it relates to basic education, was actually on the impact of the pandemic, so I'll speak a little bit about some of our monitoring work there and the impact for learning. So the purpose then is to present the analysis, implications, impacts, and progress of the present BRSONA to committees. So some of the strategic priority areas as we consider where the BRSONA fits into our priorities and plans. A year or two ago, the President outlined five major goals for the next 10 years in the country. And for basic education, the fourth goal there was the big one, namely that our schools should have better educational outcomes and that every 10-year-old would be able to read for meaning. So that was one strategic goal that was set by the President. Now in the BRSONA, we have four goals for the next year, and these are obvious given the current state of the country with the pandemic and the economy. So there were no education-specific goals that were highlighted very prominently this year. This diagram shows how the different plans fit together, the long-term plans like the NDP, how those feed into the medium-term plans like the MTSF, as well as our sector plan, the action plans 2024, other five-year plans like the strategic plans of the departments, but then also how our planning is affected by international plans and commitments at the level of SDGs and the African Union. But then also how the BRSONA fits into updating plans and tweaking them for a one-year horizon, how these influence annual performance plans for departments. So it's quite a complicated process, but the BRSONA does have a role to play in setting direction. This, for your noting, is just the 27 goals in the sector plan. Where they have a major focus on improving early learning outcomes. The first 13 goals are all about specific educational outcomes that we aim to improve upon, and then goals 14 to 24 are all the different things that we need to do in order to achieve those goals. The BRSONA obviously sets government priorities. It determines our priorities in the departments and in the sector, commits us publicly to these priorities, and therefore it has implications for our planning. Moving to this year's BRSONA, there was not very much on basic education that featured in the BRSONA this year. Two main issues were mentioned. One is the impact of the pandemic on learning disruptions, and the other issue that was noted in BRSONA was the priority around ECD and early learning. So the President said that the schooling disruption placed a huge burden on learners, teachers, and families, and that it is our priority for this year to regain lost time and improve educational outcomes from the early years through to high school and post-school education and training. And then on ECD and early learning, he noted that equally we need to give attention to issues affecting children, including improving school readiness, ECD planning, and funding. So with that in mind, the two areas to focus on briefly today will be ECD and COVID-19. But first, just briefly to consider, to remind ourselves of some of the main themes coming out of recent SONAs. The June 2019 SONA, the first SONA of the new administration, or the current administration, really highlighted the issue of reading, the goal again of every 10-year-old being able to read for meaning, the commitment to implement an early grade reading program consisting of lesson plans, materials, and professional support to teachers. It was also highlighted the need to roll out our assessment plans, where we do have a new national assessment system coming into play to allow more consistent measurements at the grade 3, 6, and 9 levels, which is in line with the NDP goals. Then also there was pronouncements made around the future and preparing for the skills and jobs of the future. Therefore, the commitments to introduce subjects like coding and robotics and data analytics. We produced a bubble chart to kind of illustrate the weight given to different topics, at least from an education perspective in the recent SONAs. In 2020 SONA, we saw a growing emphasis, especially on ECD, with the migration to ECD becoming a key issue. But there was also quite a bit on early learning. A similar chart we did comparing the 2020 SONA and the 2021 SONA. And obviously now the big new thing is COVID-19 and the school disruptions, as well as some focus on ECD. The other areas around early learning outcomes were somewhat more tangential. So then, around ECD, given that this was mentioned in this year's SONA, I just have two slides to present today, noting that there is a more comprehensive portfolio committee briefing scheduled for the 9th of March. So I'm not going to speak at length about ECD, but just to note that the various work streams around preparing for the ECD migration have been making substantial progress in recent times and have been making especially progress with working together with the provincial departments and also improved concurrence between DSD and DDE. Preparations for the final proclamations, President's Minute and President's Note have also been made with the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor. A comprehensive diagnostic report has been completed on the resources that have been identified for transfer. And as mentioned, there will be a much more comprehensive briefing for the Portfolio Committee on the 9th of March. Partly what will be covered in that briefing in much more detail are the strategies that we have for improving the quality of ECD beyond merely achieving the transfer. And so the big quality improvement strategies are around the curriculum for children aged 0 to 5, implementing a continuum of programs for all children aged birth to 5, improving the quality and availability of training and development opportunities for ECD practitioners, as well as career pathing for them. Just improving coordination around the different early childhood development services that exist. And lastly, improving a flexible funding and provisioning framework. So moving then to schooling in the pandemic, noting that the President expressed concern about the disruptions to learning that have occurred as a result of the pandemic. And so I've been involved in some monitoring and evaluation around how much time has been lost, what were school attendance rates like once schools reopened last year, how anxious have parents been regarding sending children back to school, monitoring the health risk of reopening schools both to learners and to teachers, monitoring how much time has been lost, the implications of lost teaching time for potentially lost learning, monitoring school readiness and also monitoring other social protection aspects of schooling, in particular the provision of school meals. And so I have a few slides with some information on these questions. And they draw partly on DBE data, but also on the NIDCRAM survey, which I have been involved in analyzing some of this data and writing reports as far as education is concerned. The NIDCRAM survey is a household survey conducted through a mobile methodology. It's a nationally representative sample of households, so one can see children not only when they're at school, but also those not attending. Three waves have been conducted. The first wave happened in April last year during the time when schools were still closed. Then a second wave happened in July when schools were partially open, so only grades 6, 7, 11, and 12 were open at that time. And then a third wave was conducted in November once schools were entirely open, or all the grades were open. And follow-up surveys are planned for 2021 to continue to monitor what is happening. In terms of school readiness, the DBE did several monitoring exercises in fairly large numbers of schools around the country. What we saw between June, July, and August was increasing levels of readiness across all nine of the thematic areas of readiness that were covered in the monitoring tool, and that was encouraging. So I think the system definitely managed to adjust to a completely new set of operating protocols. Looking at attendance rates amongst children, and this is obviously important for thinking about the potential effects of the pandemic on learning and possibly on dropouts in the future. So the graph shows, the green bars show attendance rates in July for the different grades, and the blue bars show attendance rates in November for the different grades. And the way the question was asked in the NIDCRAM household survey was whether a child attended school at some point in the last 7 days, so in the last week before the survey. What we saw in July was, as one would expect, the open grades, 6, 7, 11, and 12, had much higher attendance rates than the closed grades. But even in the closed grades, you do see some level of attendance, and that is because schools were allowed to request permission to open those grades, and I think especially private schools did so. And so we do see quite varying attendance rates by grade. The highest attendance in July was noted amongst grade 12 students, obviously with the urgency around preparing for the NSC exams. By November, however, in blue, the good news is that attendance rates had bounced back to what looked like kind of usual rates. But this is a weekly attendance rate, so it does mean that the child had attended at some point in the previous week. So that this would overstate daily attendance rates. Because of rotational timetabling, children may have attended in the last week, even if they're not attending every day. That has to be kept in mind. This shows attendance rates by province in July and November. In July, we saw quite a bit of variation across the provinces in attendance rates. This would have been only for the so-called open grades in July. But by November, we saw uniformly high attendance rates across the provinces, which is good news. We also looked at attendance rates in July and November by household socioeconomic status. And what was interesting to see in July and concerning was that for grades that were closed, the children in the richest 10% of households were actually quite likely to be attending school. About half, 49% of that group of households had children attending school even in the closed grades. So it would seem that in July, more affluent households were more likely to be able to access education and learning during the time of schools being partially open. By November, when all grades would be open, we saw uniformly high attendance rates across socioeconomic status of households. So keeping schools open then seems to be a key part of us providing equitable opportunities to learners. Of course, this doesn't fully show the effect of rotational timetabling. So it might be that in more affluent households, less time is being lost due to rotational timetabling. If the schools that the children are attending in maybe have smaller classes already and are therefore able to accommodate more teaching time for learners. So it is possible that there is still not quite an equal access to schooling, even now when all grades are open. But at least by November, there seems to be much more equal attendance. We also looked at anxiety amongst parents and household respondents about returning to school during the pandemic. In July, we saw really high levels of worry. And by November, for all socioeconomic status households, we see decreasing levels of worry. Especially, it's interesting to note that amongst the more affluent households, you see them less likely to be very worried about returning to school. In terms of access to school meals, in normal circumstances before the pandemic, using data like the General Household Survey, we see that at least 65% of households had children receiving meals at school on a weekly basis. In July, at the time when not all grades were actually attending school, we saw overall 25% of households with learners having received a meal in the last week. And at the time in July, that rate was much worse for children in grades that were not yet open, and was much better in for grades that were attending school. By November, across all learners, we see about 48% of households receiving a meal in the last week. So it increased substantially compared to July, but was not quite at the normal rate of 65% that we see previously. But it has to be said that we're not quite sure why it's not quite at normal levels according to this data. It might be to some extent the difference in survey methodology between the NITSCRAM survey and the General Household Survey. Obviously, this is a telephonic survey, whereas the household survey was done in person. But also, this asks about the last week, and currently, we know that schools may be operating slightly differently. There's rotational timetabling. The ways in which meals may be served may also be adapting to the pandemic. For instance, one has heard reports of things like monthly meal packages being sent home with children. One hears of children being unlikely to come to school to receive a meal on days where they are not having class. So it is as if the gap between all levels and the current levels observed in November are necessarily reflective of schools not operating their NSNP programs as usual. That should just be noted. And then if we restrict the sample just to food insecure households, we know that the NSNP is well targeted, so a strong majority of children in food insecure households normally receive meals at school, and that level in November was 59%, up from 29% in July. So we'll keep monitoring this because we know that child hunger has been negatively affected by the pandemic. If we turn now to the health risk of opening schools, so cases of COVID-19, this table just shows reports from provinces about the numbers of educators, learners, and non-teaching staff who were COVID positive. What we do see consistently is higher numbers amongst educators and other staff than amongst learners, which is significant because obviously there are far more learners in the system. And a similar pattern is observed when it comes to fatalities that have been reported. And so that is, consistent with all the other evidence about the virus much less severely affecting children than adults. So what do we know then, both from our own monitoring data and international research as it emerges about the impact of the virus on children and on schooling? Well, we do know that children are less likely to become infected than adults. We know that they are much less likely to be severely ill if they do get infected. We also see that children do not appear to be playing a big role in spreading the virus. It's not that they can't spread the virus, but they certainly don't appear to be super spreaders. You know, initially that was the fear. The general consensus is that school closures were not a very effective part of slowing the spread of COVID-19. Conversely, that reopening schools have not contributed to an unacceptably large spread in the virus. In South Africa, the NICD made a similar conclusion, noting that there were no consistent changes in incidence trends associated with timing of opening or closing of schools in South Africa. That was a January release from them. It's harder to make conclusive statements about teachers than it is about children. Obviously, teachers, given their age profile, are a relatively at-risk group, but we don't have evidence that they are at more risk than similar-age workers in other professions. We also can't say that teacher infections and teacher fatalities were caused by attending school. It's too early to make conclusive statements about that. With the new variant that has been prevalent in the country, one might wonder whether it might affect children differently to the earlier version of the virus. The short answer is that it doesn't appear to be the case. So this shows hospitalizations since August of the last few months separately by different age groups. And what you can see is that younger children in particular had much lower numbers of weekly hospitalizations. You can see the green line for 5 to 9 year olds is very low. The yellow line for 10 to 14 year olds also very low. Slightly higher numbers of hospitalizations for 15 to 19 year olds and for 20 to 24 year olds. But even there, the numbers are quite a lot lower than for older people. Similar pattern exists for fatalities. For instance, someone aged 50 to 54 was 856 times as likely to die as someone aged 5 to 9. So even with the new variant, it does seem that children are very unlikely to be severely affected. So some of the main conclusions then, we do see attendance rates bouncing back significantly since July. So that's good news for mitigating the amount of time that is being lost to learning. But of course, rotational timetabling is ongoing. So, you know, we estimate that in 2020, for the grades that didn't open initially, about 60% of the year's school days were lost, which is obviously a large disruption to learning. This year, you know, schools are open, so we anticipate less losses, but with rotational timetabling still in place, the disruptions are still continuing. We obviously need to continue to monitor the receiving of meals. And so going forward, given both the amount of the risk to children in terms of missing school as well as their relatively low health risk, the intention is to keep schools open as far as possible, with all precautions obviously in place. And now going forward, the big priority, as the President mentioned, is the recovery of learning. If we recover learning, or the extent to which we recover learning, this will also mitigate against increases in dropout rates, because we do know that the biggest predictor of dropping out of school in grades 10, 11, and 12 is earlier learning foundations in things like literacy and numeracy, which equips one to be able to cope with the curriculum in later years. And so we do know from other international studies of disruptions to schooling of this magnitude, things like earthquakes or other natural disasters, that where those occur and children lose a year of schooling, it tends to have lifelong consequences, you know, lower educational outcomes overall, lower lifetime earnings. We also know that those effects are usually unequally felt across socioeconomic status, where the more vulnerable children end up usually with the biggest negative impact. And so our fight now to recover learning is going to be crucial for future social and economic inequality. And so obviously the DBE is doing a lot to address the recovery of learning, currently around curriculum, revising annual teaching plans, trying to maximize the amount of learning time that is possible currently given the ongoing presence of the pandemic. But for many years to come, the priorities on early learning, which in fact have been really highlighted in recent donors by the president, those priorities are simply just more of a priority than ever. Early learning, ECD, reading, early numeracy, those things remain the focus. They have been the focus in recent donors, in the MTSF and the NDP, and that is the key focus going forward. So that is it. We ask the committees to note this analysis and to discuss some of the implications for the sector. Thank you very much. Back to you, DM.
Thank you so much for the presentation, Chairperson. This is our presentation. Over to you.
So thank you very much, DM. I think we were just too ambitious. This presentation was a lot for one day. Members, we've got 10 minutes to engage with the presentations from DBE. Can I know 10? Any engagement from the members? There's this iPad again, and Yazi, who is this person? Can you just identify yourself?
And his mic is not even muted, iPad. Okay.
Can I note Honorable Slindile? And then after that, Honorable Ngobo, Honorable Member with an iPad that is not named. I can't say who must speak because I don't see who you are. So if your hand is up and I have not mentioned you, who are you? All right. Honorable Slindile?
Thank you, Chairperson. Greetings to everyone. And can I keep my video off because of the network? I have questions. Thank you so much. I have questions with NSFAS. Last year, we have learned to go to their students. They fund NSFAS, but also they fund Funza Lusaka. So my question to them, is their system not able to pick up if a student is being funded by two different institutions? And also with Department of Basic Education, in 2020 was not an easy year, that we all know. But we also had challenges in most of the schools whereby you found most of the teachers were not there, especially for key subjects like mathematics, life science and physics. I can name one school, A.M. Mula, which is in Indwetwe, what 17 Tafamas, where teachers of those subjects only came towards the end of the year. And it even shows in their pass rates, where out of plus 30 students, only 5 passed. And out of those 5 that passed, 3 of them got OH and 2 got D. So what is the department doing in assisting these kids? Because now you find the majority of those kids are failing matric and they don't even have imali. So we are kuma finishing school, so they will have to be stuck at home. Their results are a mess. They can't even write ama subjects. So what is the department going to do about it? Thank you.
Bob Lobo?
Thank you.
thank you very much, Chairperson, and members of the honorable members of the portfolio committee. I will not open my video like I had a problem last time. Chairperson, I just wish to raise two maybe questions. I want to start anyway by maybe thanking the presenters, especially the first one, for saying something about the good work which the teachers are doing. Most of the time, when it's time for the results to come out, teachers are the last to be recognized for the good work which they do. Now, Chairperson, there was mention again under NSFAS, there was mention of the teachers' centers as being used by NSFAS, I would believe, together with the teacher, with the teachers or representatives of the teacher organizations, to assist learners fill the forms or whatever other needs they may be having, but in particular filling in the forms. I don't know how much that has been popularized, because not all the teachers' centers are used for that purpose. That I know for sure. I can quote some teacher organizations which have not seen, they have centers, clip beautiful centers, and those centers are underutilized, in particular when it comes to this role is concerned. Now, about the appointment of teachers from Funza Lushaka, what is the problem here? The teachers from Funza Lushaka have been, I want to get a response from the department whether maybe that it's different now. They have been given a priority most of the time when it comes to the appointments, over and above those, as compared to those that battle to go to get, find money and go to the training on their own. One would have liked to hear the responses on that one. Maybe the last one, Chairperson, if one would just hear in two sentences, what's the pace of moving ECD into the mainstream. This has been talked about for some time now. Is the pace, are we happy with the pace? Is the department happy with the pace? One knows that it cannot happen overnight, but I do feel that we are not giving this a priority it deserves. Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson and members of the Honorable
Suwena.
Thank you, Chairperson. Then and we also well. Presentation.
We can have you hear you, Honorable Honorable Suwela? Honorable Suwela? Can the host mute Honorable Suwela?
Honorable Suela?
Papa Mapia Lepa, Chair. You can
see
it. It's tough in Mpumalanga.
Isn't the Kundus there in Mpumalanga?
That's terrible. Typical of the network in Mpumalanga.
Mama Sabela, is it you that he has not named the iPad? Because I'm tempted now to allow the department to respond.
He says, or she says, or he says, it's Lihihi. I don't know, but he or she wrote on the chat group that his or her name is Lihihi.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much, DM. Honorable Lihihi, then, can we allow you to speak?
Chairperson.
Yeah.
Chairperson.
I'm listening. Mama Sabela? Honorable, can we allow you to speak? Honorable Hihi, are you available? Hey, I'm Fayaz Manji, what to do?
You are in trouble, Chair.
Maybe it's a robot, Chair.
What is that about here?
There is a ghost.
Aymo. Pella, also, our host, how do you just accept an iPad that is not named? Because you can allow people who are not supposed to be in the meeting to be in the meeting.
Infiltration, Chairperson. Hey.
Okay. DM, can I... Okay. Let me...
I think the question that I had, Rengobo partly...
No, but why am I muted? Llewellyn, who is the host here?
Chairperson, you are unmuted. Chairperson, you can go ahead.
No, I'm reading this chat. There is a chat from this person of the iPad.
She's having problems, Chairperson, with connectivity.
Okay. But the point that I wanted to...
I was saying, who is this person? Because you cannot just say they were a person by the name of iPad. Who is the person? How has that person been allowed to be in the meeting? Maybe if they just explain that it's Honorable so-and-so, so that we all understand and we all become free in this meeting.
Yeah, I think you have. Llewellyn, who is this person of the iPad?
I believe, as per the chat, it's Honorable Lahihi. But she's having problems with her phone currently, Chairperson. I would suggest that Honorable Lahihi maybe put her question on the
Honorable
chat.
Honorable Lahihi, can you write your question down? Because we can't get you through this. All right. The Funza Lushaka recipient, I think Ubabungobo raised it partly, that it looks like the department is prioritizing them, and because in the same department you would have contradicting views. When we were on oversight recently, the MEC in KZN had raised the issue of Funza Lushaka and how as the department in KZN they are dealing with it, because in his views is that there are parents, and in his situation he raised that many parents who are coming from rural areas in the KZN have came to see him, not only them but also the recipients of not the recipients but those that
have been sent by their parents to the colleges and universities to do teaching, they are not prioritized. And in many cases, it is parents who are coming from homes where there is poverty, where in many instances, that is now a KZN scenario, where parents had to sell their livestock for a child to go to school. And with an expectation that child will come back and be able to plow back in the family, you would know how we do things in many households. So the issue of always searching for those Funza Lusaka recipients who actually benefited, who are privileged in his view, and to some extent I agree with him, they are privileged to an extent, because they had this bazaar from Funza Lushaka, and again when they come back they are the first ones on the list. And if you can compare those scenarios, you do really see that there is a discrimination of some sort to those that are not the recipients of Funza Lushaka. I see now Honorable Sewela also is asking what has happened to his question. And the reality, we did not even hear his question as well. Honorable Sewela, you broke. So if you can just write your question as well. You broke. We could not even hear anything from you. So if you can write your question so that the department can be able to include your question. And Honorable Lihihi as well.
Hello, Chair.
She is saying...
Chairperson.
No, Honorable Sewela is saying that his question is what happens in a situation where an applicant has been granted an ESPAS but could not pass matric that year of application. This applicant then repeats and passed in subsequent year. And then the question from Lihihi is saying, I don't know this, Kahului. Okay, Kahului, are universities still asking students to sign acknowledge of debt to the university, even though they are funded by NSFAS? I can't make sense of this question. I'm not sure if anyone can assist. Are the universities still asking students to sign acknowledge of debt to the university, even though they are funded by NSFAS? We've got teachers for basic education. Probably they will assist what is this question. DM, over to you. We don't have a lot of time left, but please try to cover everything as far as you can with your team.
Thank you, Chair. Some questions really, I feel that they were supposed to have been asked when higher education was still in the ministry, unless there is an official of higher education that is, especially that by the Hihi, that a child applied and was granted the bursary but did not pass, then it falls off. Then you go back to school, do matric, you apply. Same as a university. If you have applied to a particular university, then you get accepted pending the results. Then the results come, you are failed. Then everything collapses. Then you start afresh, you go back to matric, then you reapply. That's how I think it should happen. So, Chair, on the Funza Lushaka and the other students that go to universities on their own, which I believe where we are seated is a thing of just an immediate pass, because if really those students, their parents did not have money, they should have been a part of the recruitment. Recruitment is done in provinces, and provinces look at their needs in terms of teachers. Then it happens that these students sometimes, they are recruited based on the needs of the province, the Funza Lushaka students. Then when they arrive at a university, some change
the course or change the subjects of specialization. When they changed, the province needed math teachers. And then when they arrived there, they did isiZulu or isiSwati. When they come back with their qualifications, really, they won't be easily replaced because with the province or the district, because it's done in provinces, but also in districts and circuits. And each circuit knows exactly what do we want, what are the skills that we want from the teachers, the new teachers. Then they get there, they do all the processes, and they go to university. That includes even, because Fundalushaka is also given to poor students. And yes, I know that some discrepancies might happen during the recruitment, because recruitment is done by people. And Regina can be given this job to recruit, and Regina will start at home and take her children who do not qualify in a sense that who do not meet the needs of the district, circuit, or province. Then when they come back, it becomes a problem. Their absorption becomes a problem. But the learners, students who go on their own, if there is a Funza Lushaka who specialized in Siswati, and this student who did the subjects that are required by the school, schools, I know, they appoint according to their needs. Those students, they will be appointed. That's why you see the placement of Funza Lushaka is not at 100%, and it doesn't mean that nobody was appointed. The relevant skill was appointed. That's how it happens. We are not excluding those who went on their own. That's why majority of them. I visited some schools this year. I found young people, and I found that those that are, because when I saw them, I thought it's Funza Lushaka. I said, hey, Funza Lushaka, come here. Then many young people remained. Then I said, hey, who are you? They said, no, we're not part of Funza Lushaka, but they have been appointed by the school. So it's not always that when you see a young teacher at a school, it's a Funza Lushaka product. They are not. So we are going to monitor if really they get this advantage, even if they are relevant to the school based on that they are not part of Funza Lushaka. That one we will investigate and check. On the NSFAS and Funza Lushaka check, we recruit as basic education through our provinces and our districts. Then we have this number, we assign them to higher education. And even the budget, the Funza Lushaka budget, yes, it's with basic education, but it gets transferred to higher education, but not higher education as a department, to NSFAS. It is managed by NSFAS. So it may not be easy. It may happen. I'm not denying that it may happen, but it may not be easy because the Funza Lushaka budget is managed by NSFAS. So they cannot give the same student NSFAS and still make her benefit or him benefit from Funza Lushaka, because they are the ones that are managing even the budget for Funza Lushaka in the universities. So I don't think that is possible. In the event it is possible, it's just a discrepancy, it needs to be corrected, but universities, they do pick that up. When a university receives two funds from two different companies, they call the student and say, hey, you have two funding here. And all of them, they do cover everything. Choose one. We can't take two. And they don't take two universities. They have identified that as a mistake that it used to happen in the past, but now it doesn't happen. The universities, they are able to pick that up. So on the ECD, yeah, we did come to present to the portfolio committee and the select committee. We even presented an action plan which goes up to 2024. Where we are seated, we are still on the right track where we are seated right now. If members would want DBE to come again and present as to where actually
are we who will come and do that. But and we are working well with the Department of Social Development. There are no hiccups that much, except for the COVID-19, which prohibited us to do some of the activities which we said we're going to do, like meeting stakeholders, et cetera, et cetera. But now we do meet them on Zoom because we wanted to make a roadshow in all the provinces and also having Department of Social Development in provinces to meet with Department of Education in provinces to unpack this thing. But it is on the right track as far as we are concerned. Chair, I think I've covered all the questions in respect of time, unless if there's one flesh that must be fitted in the skeleton that I've given, I can allow officials to come in. DG, are you still here that you can add if I left one aspect of the answers? DG Pariyaki? Or Dr. Taylor?
Deputy Minister, I think Dr. Taylor and Mr. Kutsia will come in.
Okay, please let them come in quickly because time is against the members. Mr. Kutsia?
Deputy Minister, thank you very much. I just want to add one thing in terms of the question that was raised by the honourable members around prioritising Fundza Lushaka. And I just want to put it in context. The first point of context that I would like to highlight is the fact that in terms of the 28,000 graduates that graduated in 2018, only about 4,000 of those were Fundza Lushaka funded. So it is really, in comparison to the bigger whole, it is a small number of students. And the second point of context that I would like to give is that in the presentation, we've shared the priority subject areas. And when one look at those priority areas, it is only a small number of subjects that are funded by Fundza Lushaka. So all the other subject areas are still out there that for appointments to be made. I thought I just wanted to highlight that, and then also just to say that I see Thandi is in the meeting. Deputy Minister, she can also add around some of the NISFAS questions that was asked. Thank you very much.
Yes, please. I saw her. Thandi, can you come in quickly?
Yes, thank you, DM. To be honest, I think you answered the one question perfectly, DM, in relation to if a student is not successful in gaining a place. Yes, that student, even if they had qualified financially for NISFAS, they would then have to reapply the following year, both for the financial aid through NISFAS as well as for a place in a post-school institution. So I think you answered that perfectly. In response to the question about the acknowledgement of debt, maybe just to explain, there are two separate processes. On the one hand, there is a process of dealing with the historic debt of NISFAS qualifying students who were registered in 2018. Those are students that may have accumulated debt prior to the new bursary scheme being introduced. They may have, been out of the system for a while. They may have accumulated debt because of the cap on funding previously. And also because of the family contributions that were previously in place. That historic debt process is ongoing, and it requires there are certain requirements from the NISFAS side, including acknowledgement of debt, which would then allow those qualifying students to register. Those are a specific group of students, and the funding was allocated in 2019 by the Minister of Higher Education and Training to NISFAS to resolve the historic debt of those NISFAS-funded students who had accumulated debt prior to 2018. in terms of other arrangements, students who are fee-paying students at institutions do accumulate debt at institutions, and those institutions have their own policies in terms of how they allow students to register. And in terms of those policies, students may be required to make debt payment arrangements with institutions in order to be allowed to register. But again, across the system, that differs from institution to institution. So the historic debt generally refers to the NSFAS process, but of course, there are other students that accumulate debt who are fee-paying students. Thanks very much.
Dr. Taylor?
Thank you, DM. I think I'm covered. I think the questions were mainly for the other presentation. So I think I'm fine. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Back to you, Chair. Thank you so much, Chairperson.
No, thank you very much, DM and your team. And thank you very much to you, Linda, as well. I didn't know you were still part of the meeting. Members, that's the presentation and the responses from the department, which I believe they have responded adequately. But I think, DM, and I've heard your response quite very clearly. But I think in respect to what I was raising, really, I think the department should consider to, when they employ teachers, you know, to employ teachers equally so. Because it looks like now, and the perception outside there, it still is that when you've got a Funza Lushaka bazaar, then it's your birthright. Appointment is your birthright. You can't even be on the waiting list. You are appointed generally very quick. And meanwhile, other learners that have made, I mean, other qualifying teachers that have, I mean, to be teachers, must still wait for them to be appointed. But anyway, I think it must really debate and look into. Be that as it may, I think we have really come to an end of our meeting. Not unless there is a member who feels he or she has not been adequately responded to. Thank you very much. And members, I am requesting that the minutes that we are supposed to adopt in this meeting, we adopt in the next week, because next week we are having a presentation on the NSC results. That is the only presentation we are having, but of course it will be Umalusi and the department. So I'm requesting that we adopt the minutes in the next on the 2nd of March, if the meeting agrees.
Supported. Moderated.
We agree, Chair.
Okay.
No, fine. And okay, thank you very much. With that, then let me thank you, DM. Thank you very much for being part of our meeting with your entourage. And convey our thanks to the Minister of Higher Education, Linda. Thank you very much for honoring our meeting. And thanks to all the members that have been part of the meeting. The meeting is adjourned.
Chairperson, I have a problem now. My gadget, you know, Chairperson, that I never had a problem of the signal. It's happening for the second time now. And you noticed today that quite a number of members had a signal problem. Can that be looked into, Chairperson? That is just a by the way.
Okay, Babungabo, I don't know. You know, there is a WhatsApp group from my province where members were complaining of their gadgets as well, but their complaint was that it becomes hot. I haven't experienced it. It becomes so hot that they must put it in the fridge and then it's not working properly. But then they were referred to Sally. So maybe if you can speak to Sally as well to check probably what could be the problem.
Okay. thankful to the chair.
All right. Okay, but more.